and my fellow Pennsylvanians.
This state's electoral votes are key to who wins the presidency, and both of the candidates know it.
We win Pennsylvania, we win the whole deal. You know that. Just like last time.
But states like Pennsylvania are going to be incredibly important.
The only thing left on the board is Pennsylvania. The president cannot get to the finish line without the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
One state all four candidates are visiting today is Pennsylvania. Its 20 electoral votes are highly coveted, and the Keystone State could end up being one of the determining factors in the race.
Jill's a Philly girl, but I'm a Scranton girl.
The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania is the oldest appellate court in the United States. In fact, it actually predates the founding of our great republic. The court consists of seven justices who are elected for 10-year terms. For better or worse, they have to run, and they have to run with the party label. Democrats have a 4-2 majority. Now, I realize that adds up to six. The very impressive Chief Justice Max Baer, he died in September 2022 after a storied career. Both parties will be watching the state Supreme Court race in the Commonwealth as a bellwether going into 2024. Dan McCaffrey is the Democratic nominee for the state Supreme Court. He's currently a Superior Court judge. I'm looking forward to learning more about his really unique background and his perspective on the law.
Judge Dan McCaffrey, welcome to my kitchen table.
Nice to be here. Glad you invited me on.
So we're in the final days, the final stretch of a statewide campaign. Are you getting a chance to catch your breath, or it's not nonstop?
40 days, but who's counting? It's nonstop. I mean, it's been quite a whirlwind. I've said this to people before. I ran in 2019 for the Superior Court, and it was actually kind of fun. The Superior Court I was a trial judge at the time I ran, and I was working 9 to 5 every day in a courtroom. And the campaign trail itself was kind of moderate. You know, you would go to campaign events at night, you would go to political events, that kind of thing. But the Supreme Court race has been something completely different. It's taken on a life of its own. It's 12-hour days, pretty much 7 days a week.
Well, you're no stranger to long days. Let's take listeners back. You have an incredible background before your time on the bench. Particularly, I'm reminded of your time at West Point. 12 hours is a walk in the park, I'm sure, for a typical day at West Point. So share with folks a little about your military service and your time up there.
Well, so just to clarify, Ari, I was at West Point Prep. There's a difference. West Pointers will be happy to point that out to you. At the age of 18, I actually went enlisted. West Point Prep is actually a program that's administered by the United States Military Academy at West Point. It is a combination of active duty soldiers that are identified through the officer corps that they believe would be good West Pointers and good officers, and individuals coming directly out of high school who, for one reason or another, can't get in directly to West Point. So the class at West Point Prep is usually broken up of recent high school graduates and enlisted members of the military. I actually went into the United States Army. I joined at 18. I was a cavalry scout. I started off at Armored Cavalry. I did my basic and AIT, which is advanced individual training, at Fort Knox, Kentucky. We were Armored Cavalry, and I was assigned to the legendary 1st Cavalry Division. The legend occurred long before me, by the way. You know, they were the most decorated unit in Vietnam. If you've seen any, modern military kind of reenactment movies of the Vietnam era, you'll see the 1st Cavalry Division is always prominently displayed in those particular movies. But I served with the 1st Cavalry Division for about 2 years, and the officer corps of the 1st Cavalry Division first approached me about applying to West Point Prep. And I looked into it, and it's something I thought I might be interested in. So I actually applied to West Point Prep through the officer recommendations. I went through an interview process, and I was one of about, I think there are about 40 or 50 of us worldwide who were selected to attend the United States Military Academy at West Point Prep. I went to the West Point Prep School, and at that point, I'd been in the military for over 2 years, 2 years active duty, 2.5. And I realized, as a 21-year-old kid, I would have had to go back to West Point for 4 more years and then have a 5-year commitment, which basically, as a 21-year-old kid, you're thinking, this is going to be a career. Do I want to make a career in the military? I decided I did not want to become a career officer. At least at that point, I didn't want to commit to having a career in the military. So I was honorably discharged, and I enrolled in Temple University, eventually on a veteran scholarship. When I actually went through the application process, I was awarded a veteran scholarship through Temple University. I enrolled in 1986. I graduated in 2 years. I actually went both summer sessions, and then I enrolled at Temple Law School, also on a veteran scholarship. But the entire time I was in college, and for my first year of law school, I also served in the United States Army Reserve with the 304 Civil Affairs Group, which is located in the far northeast section of Philadelphia.
Well, you are a proud son of the Northeast. My late mother and her family grew up at Academy and Knights Road. So I know
right,
enough
right
about
the
far Northeast. Tell folks about, I mean, you referenced high school, and tell folks a little about your childhood.
Yeah, I'm kind of the atypical Northeast Philadelphian, as they say. My mother and father aren't from Northeast Philadelphia. If your mother-in-law is from Northeast Philadelphia, she'll tell you that generations upon generations of people that are born in the neighborhood, raised in the same neighborhood, and die in the same neighborhood. The running joke about me was I actually moved from the west side of the boulevard to the east side of the boulevard, so people thought I was a social climber. But my mom and dad are actually not from Northeast Philadelphia. My mom and dad are from Belfast, Northern Ireland. If you'll indulge me for a second, I'll tell you a little bit about their background so you kind of understand, because I think it informs a lot of my beliefs and a lot of the reasons why I do what I do.
I'd personally be quite interested as we're reflecting on just the resilience of the Good Friday agreements. President Biden was over there not too long ago. So please share with listeners.
Well, my mother and father predate the Good Friday agreements by about 70 years. My mom and dad were born in the 1920s. They were Irish Catholics from West Belfast, Northern Ireland. And as I like to tell people, if anybody knows anything about the history of Northern Ireland, especially, you know that the Catholics and the Protestants over there have had a minor disagreement going on for about 600 years now. But my father and mother were Irish Catholics. My father was the oldest of 12. My mother was actually an orphan. She was one of seven. My mom dropped out of school at about the second grade or third grade to go to work in the linen mills of Northern Ireland. My father, as the oldest of his family, went to school all the way to the seventh grade as a Christian brother school. My father had a particular skill that served him pretty well in life, and I can tell you about it firsthand. My father was really, really good with his fists. In fact, when my father was 12, he became a boxer. He followed in his father's footsteps and his grandfather's footsteps and became a boxer in Northern Ireland, a fighter. He fought his way up through three weight classes, became an All-Ireland champion as an amateur boxer, and he turned professional at the age of 16 or 17. I tell people this story because my father was given an opportunity because he was such a good fighter that none of his contemporaries were given. At the age of about 16, my father used to fight at what's called the Royal Ulster Hall in Belfast on Friday nights. And there was a guy from my father's neighborhood, West Belfast, who was a Protestant. He owned a printing company, and he used to come watch my father fight. And he was so thrilled that a kid from his neighborhood had kind of fought his way up through the ranks and become an All-Ireland champion that he approached my father after one of his fights on a Friday night. And he offered my father an opportunity, which was unheard of for a 16-year-old Catholic kid, a Protestant business owner, a well-respected member of the community who owned and ran a printing company, offered my dad the opportunity to work. He actually offered my dad a job. My father was obviously over the moon. He was thrilled. He was so enamored with himself that he promptly ran out and proposed to my mother. And my mother told him, "I'll consider marrying you." She was only 15. He was 16. "I'll consider marrying you if you stick with the job for a year." So my father became an apprentice in a printing company. My mother and father were promptly married. My dad was 17. My mom was 16. My father continued on boxing, and he continued on as an apprentice in a printing program right up until around his 21st birthday. When he's married with my mother, he had three young children, my oldest sister, Molly, my brother, Seamus, and my brother, Noel. And on July 12th, which was the day that sparks the British marching season or the Protestant marching season through Northern Ireland, my dad came back to his cubicle in his printing company, and his cubicle was decorated. And it wasn't decorated with with "Happy Birthday, Seamus." It was decorated with "God Save the Queen." It was decorated with the Union Jack. Imagine, if you will, if you're Jewish and you come back to your place of employment, and you see a swastika written there or Nazi symbols. Or if you're Black in America and you come back and you find a noose hanging in your place of work, you might react like my dad reacted. My dad ripped down the offending materials, and my father turned around and he was confronted by his four coworkers. These were four individuals that he had worked with every day for the last 4 or 5 years. And they promptly held my father down and they beat him into a coma with a wooden mallet. My dad woke up 30 days later from a coma. The side of his face was caved in. Obviously, his boxing career was over because he was told he could not box anymore because of the damage to his eye. To make matters worse or to add insult to injury, my father was actually fired from this job that he had had for 5 years with the printing company by the same man who had given him the job 5 years before for, as they put it, fighting on the job. My father, of course, looked at my mother. He looked at his three oldest children, and he realized that in Ireland there was no place for his family. Like all of our ancestors, my dad got on a boat, came to this country to make a better life for himself and to create an opportunity for a better life for his children. As I mentioned, my father's the oldest of 12. My mom was an orphan of seven. the rest of our family, or the majority members of my family, are still back in Northern Ireland. So my father and mother came to this country literally knowing nobody but each other. The family legend is my dad had $56 in his pocket, but he saved up enough money after 18 months to bring my mom and three older siblings to this country. My dad eventually immigrated to Philadelphia because Philadelphia at that time was the printing capital of the world. Curtis Publishing was in Philadelphia. Some of the other big in-house printing companies were based out of Philadelphia. And my father got a job with Curtis Printing right down there at 6th and Chestnut. Eventually, my father got a joined the printers union, a typographical members union, and he became an organizer and a shop steward for the union here in Philadelphia. My mother was lucky enough, after having seven children, she used to tell people all the time, Ari, that it took her seven children before she realized what was causing it. But my mom got a job as a cleaning lady. She was a janitor for the Philadelphia School District, and she too joined a union. It was SEIU. My mother spent 26 years as a cleaning lady in the Philadelphia school districts, and my father became an organizer for the communication workers in the printers union. So that's kind of our family immigration story. The original thought process for my mom and dad is they had a close friend who was working in California, but we moved to Philadelphia, and my mother loved it so much that they bought a house, and this is where they raised their family. We were originally from the Germantown section of Philadelphia. We ultimately moved up into Northeast, into the Ronhurst section. I grew up in a little enclave called Bell's Corner, which was predominantly Irish, Italian, and Jewish. Great neighborhood, idyllic place to grow up in the 1960s and 1970s.
Well, thanks so much. I think I'm speaking for listeners for sharing that. And it's a distinctly American story of leaving adversity and coming to the land of opportunity. So what year did they arrive in America?
Well, my dad had to go to Canada first, because back then you couldn't come right to America. You needed a sponsor and you needed a job. My dad had a distant aunt who lived in Montreal. So my father came to Montreal. He lived in Montreal, saved up enough money. My mother and father spent about 4 years before my father could locate a job and a sponsor. And again, the reason they chose Philadelphia, of course, was because, as I mentioned, Philadelphia was the printing capital of the world at that time, or at least the States. My father had another distant cousin from Philadelphia that agreed to be a sponsor. So they waited in Canada for 5 years until my father could locate a job and a sponsor for America and have his application for a green card, I guess at the time, processed. So they waited up there for 5 years. I think they came to America in late 1950s, 57, 58.
Well, I was asking particularly because this is in proximity to President Kennedy's administration.
Right before.
Can only imagine how they were feeling with what they left and then seeing the first Irish Catholic president of their new home.
Ari, I tell everybody, when you see our family photographs from me as a little kid, everybody makes the same remark. On our wall of our house next to our graduation photos, there was a picture of John F. Kennedy and his brother Robert F. Kennedy in side profile right next to the Pope.
And then the family was a distant second and third. The Pope and
no doubt about it. Yeah. The Kennedys became like our family, if you can believe it.
So then what was the spark? At what point did you say, you know, I want to pursue a career in law? Well, was it these early stories of just a lack of justice at that period in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to kind of put it. You know, I joke around with people about my background, because a lot of people look at my background on a campaign trail and otherwise, and they see a guy who was an Army veteran. They see a guy who's a former prosecutor in the Philadelphia DA's office. And a lot of people kind of look at me and they find it hard to believe that I'm a Democrat, and I kind of laugh. But there's actually a picture of me as a little kid walking a picket line with my mom and dad. My mom and dad, as I mentioned beforehand, when they came to this country, they literally didn't know a soul. They didn't know anybody. So like every other immigrant community, they kind of found other Irish immigrants, you know, to make a life. But, you know, our family, our extended family, really became the American labor movement. As I mentioned, my dad became an organizer for the printers union. My mom was an SEIU member, so they were very active in kind of union politics. And union politics in the 60s and 70s were very closely aligned with Democratic politics. So there are pictures of me and my brothers and sisters walking a picket line from as early as four. My father was always very socially conscious. He was really one of those guys, Ari. Strangely enough, he got involved in union politics, but he always kind of wanted to make a difference in his neighborhood. My dad was Irish from Northern Ireland. He didn't know anything about American sports, yet he tried to coach baseball. Didn't know what the hell he was doing. He tried to coach our football teams. He was very active. He was a Democratic committee person. So he always wanted to be a good neighbor and a good friend to people, always try to help people out. So my father kind of volunteered at the early age. We kind of grew up in it. That's the best way I can explain it to people. But I also think those family stories from Belfast, Northern Ireland, and the history of Irish Catholicism, as it kind of relates back to the 1950s and 1960s. My father founded a group in America called Irish Northern Aid, which was designed to raise money for Irish Catholics during the height of the Troubles. He and my uncle were intimately and heavily involved with Irish Northern Aid right up until the point my mother's house, my grandmom's house, his mother's house in West Belfast in Unity Flats was firebombed. So him and my uncle kind of backed off it a little bit, but they were always involved in kind of politics, democratic politics. I can remember as a kid sitting in my living room, my father would have coffee clatches, bringing all the neighbors in back in the 70s to meet Democratic candidates for state representative, for Congress, for mayor. So we were kind of always steeped in democratic political tradition. But my dad, like I said to you beforehand, he always told us America is his adopted country, but it's our homeland. And it was important for us to kind of give back and be good stewards of the community.
But to make the jump then from prosecutor and then your time in private practice, and then just take listeners through kind of the genesis of them, what was the spark to say, you know what, I want to pursue being on the other side and being on the bench?
There's so many facets
and so many elements of the law. And at the end of the day, it is pursuing justice. And we are a country of laws, not men, and equal justice before the law. But what was it about the bench that appealed to you?
I really think it was that kind of sense of justice that we just talked about, like with my mother and father. I always knew that the law was a vehicle to kind of make a more just society. Now, my father was always very careful to kind of, he was one of those guys that inculcated in each and every one of us to kind of belief that our legal system should level the playing field between the rich and the powerful. And as he called it, the little guy, the working class people. You know, I'd never thought about becoming a lawyer growing up. I've told people this, you know, my neighborhood, Northeast Philadelphia, is essentially comprised of police officers, municipal workers, firefighters. That's what all my family and friends were and neighbors were, police officers, firefighters, and construction workers. We didn't even know any lawyers or doctors growing up. It just wasn't part of who we were and part of our culture. When I went into the Army, I joined the Army and I came out of West Point. I went and enrolled in college, as I mentioned. And my older brother, Seamus, who's 15 years older than me, was a police officer. He joined the Marine Corps in 1968. He was honorably discharged in 1970, and he joined the Philadelphia Police Department while staying in the Marine Corps Reserves and ultimately the Air Force Reserves. So what ultimately happened was my brother Seamus developed an interest in the law because he was a police officer, and he went to court every day, and he saw what lawyers do and saw what judges did. And he went to college at night, graduated in 1977, and he decided to go on through law school and graduated law school in 1989. He went to literally college and law school for 15 years. And the reason he went to law school and college was he wanted to become a judge. He got to sit in court every single day and watch kind of injustices happen to victims and crime. And my brother Seamus kind of developed an interest in law. And it was through those conversations with my brother Seamus and my brother Gary, my older brother, that I kind of thought long and hard about going into law. When I came out, I was in college, I was a journalism major. I was thinking about a career in broadcast journalism. So this is something I'm really interested in, Ari. I may talk to you off the record about it, but it was something that was interesting to me. But through talking to my brother and talking about my brother's experiences in law school, and then I started meeting some of his friends who were going to law school with him, and they all seemed to enjoy it, I decided to go into to apply for law school. And as I mentioned, I was accepted to Temple Law School, graduated from Temple Law School. And I'd considered various options kind of coming out of law school. And one of my law school professors was a woman by the name of Joanne Epps, who was a little bit of a legend in the Temple community. She was a law school professor, ultimately became the dean of our law school, the president of the university, and she just tragically passed away.
And may she rest in peace. That really was incredibly tragic.
Yeah, it was just this week. She took over the presidency after President Wingard moved on. She tragically passed away about a week or so ago. Her funeral services are actually being conducted this week. And it was through my conversations with Joanne Epps that I decided to go into the DA's office. Joanne had been a prosecutor in the LA County DA's office, and I remember talking to her distinctly about it and talking about what it was like to be a prosecutor. And she told me about that it was the most rewarding job she had ever had while in the law. So I received one offer other than the firm I was working for, which was I interviewed at one place, which was the Philadelphia DA's office. Right away, they kind of scooped me up. The DA at the time was a Republican who was a military veteran who lost his leg in Vietnam, who later went on to become the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. He offered me a job. I readily accepted the job. And I'll be honest with you, Ari, for a blue-collar kid from Northeast Philadelphia, working as a DA was a job that kind of fit me like a glove. I mean, I loved every single second of it. I was living in my mom and dad's basement, making no money at all. But, you know, I was taking the bus and taking the L every day down to court. The camaraderie in that office was just absolutely breathtaking. The people I met in that office were true public servants in every description of the word. And it was something that I just absolutely loved to do. And it was one of those moments in your life where it just clicks. I got in there. I got to see what the job was. You got to understand that you were really representing victims of crime. Prosecutors over the last couple of years, 10, 15 years, have become somewhat demonized by the process for a variety of reasons. But when I was doing that job, I felt every day that I was wearing the white hat. I was representing victims of crime in the most crime-ridden jurisdiction in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I represented, you know, children who were abused, women who were raped. I represented shop owners, business owners who were robbed and shot, you know, attempted murder prosecutions. And there wasn't a day that I went by that I didn't go to that job, no matter how horrendous or heinous the circumstances of the crime I was prosecuting were, that I didn't feel that I was doing something good for my city and my community. And I loved every single second of that job.
Well, you've been super generous with your time, and thank you for fighting for justice for your entire professional career and serving in uniform. Give listeners, as we wind down, just an anecdote or two from outside of Philadelphia. I'm sure you've been putting on a lot of road miles, meeting all sorts of Pennsylvanians. What's on their minds? What are you hearing? What are you learning?
Well, as I mentioned, after I left the DA's office, I went and became a trial attorney. So I represented victims of negligence. I represented corporations. You name it, I did it. I did civil litigation for 16 years. And as I like to joke around with people, after complaining about bad judges for 22 years, I decided to do something about it, run for judge. I presided when I was a trial judge in Philadelphia over several hundred jury trials, waiver trials, bench trials. I was elected to the Superior Court. I've written several hundred opinions. And on the Superior Court, I've loved every single second of being on the Superior Court. We're an error-correcting court. We're the busiest appellate court in the United States of America. But I kind of tell people that I think my life kind of changed when the United States Supreme Court decision came out in the Dobbs case last year. When you read that decision, and it kind of segs into your question, you read that decision and you realize that a majority of the United States Supreme Court is now starting to peel back individual rights that have kind of evolved over the law over the last 60 years. Most people think Dobbs is limited to a reversal of Roe versus Wade, which, if that was it, would be bad enough in and of itself. But when you start reading Clarence Thomas's dissent in the Dobbs decision, you realize that he's really exhorting his fellow members of the United States Supreme Court to take a look at substantive due process, the evolution of substantive due process rights over the last 60 years. That means LGBTQ rights. It means voting rights. It means civil rights. It means workers' rights. It means all of the things that I think American society has held near and dear to its heart as a liberal democratic society over the last 60 years. And where those cases are now going to be decided is in each individual state under each individual state's constitution. So when I go out there and I talk to people, I talk to voters, I think the paramount interest on everybody's mind is those Supreme Court decisions and what's going to happen now to women's reproductive rights, what's going to happen to LGBTQ rights, civil rights, workers' rights. Is the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and the members of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court going to protect those rights, or are they going to allow kind of a rollback as you're seeing right now at the United States Supreme Court level?
Well said, and we could certainly go on for much longer. This is really great insight and perspective for our listeners. But I wish you well on the final days of this historic campaign.
Thank you very much, Ari. I appreciate you having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics. Take a minute and leave us a rating and review on your podcast platform. Please also consider following us on social media for updates and announcements regarding future episodes and new guests. You're political, so I am sure that you're on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. We are too, at PA Political Podcast. Visit our website, papoliticalpodcast.org, and send us your feedback about this episode and suggestions on future guests. Until next week.